If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret. Searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
Jamaica was a lovely one. I played her well. As we lay in the tall grass where the shadows fell. Hiding from the children so they would not tell. We would stay there till her sister rang the evening bell. Jamaica, say you will help me find a way to fill these empty hours. Say you will come again tomorrow.
The daughter of a captain on the rolling seas. She would stare across the water from the trees. Last time he was home, he held her on his knees. Said the next time they would sail away, it's where they please.
Jamaica, sail.
Help me find
a way to fill these lifeless sails and stay until my ships can find the sea.
Listening to an absolutely masterful cover of Jackson Browne's Jamaica Say You Will, performed by Los Lobos as part of their upcoming record Native Sons, due out on New West Records July 30th. 43 years into making records, Los Lobos, who actually formed in 1973, wanted to do something different for their latest release, the first on New West Records. Originally, the plan was to do an all-covers record, something the band is quite adept at doing. But upon deeper discussion, they settled on narrowing the covers list to 13 songs from native LA musicians, since East LA is home. You can only imagine what a unique set of songs appear on Native Sons, since Los Lobos themselves have a very eclectic sonic presentation, ranging from Mexican folk music to straight-ahead rock and roll. On Native Sons, they masterfully work covers from The Beach Boys, Jackson Browne, War, Buffalo Springfield, just to name a few. I had the absolute pleasure to sit down with noted producer and Los Lobos member Steve Berlin, who took me through some of the album's highlights and some of the stories behind the recordings. The conversation started when I asked Steve Berlin, the band's saxophonist and keyboard player, in a sort of tongue-in-cheek way, if he's a full member of Los Lobos at this point, since he joined the band just a few years after the band's inception.
Yeah, we're, 30 years. I better be. But, to be perfectly honest, I kind of felt like that, like the second day. So, I mean, it's that part. They've always been, very open and welcoming as anybody who's ever played with us. would attest, you know, it's the culture is pretty, pretty warm in that respect. So yeah, I was always made to, I never really felt, you know, the only time I ever really feel like I'm not, you know, like an outsider is when they start talking about high school stuff, like, right. You know, 'cause they all went to the same high school. So that, when those conversations happen, you know, like my eyes tend to glaze over, but aside from that, they don't come up all that much. So, it's you know, we've always had a musical connection that surpassed anything else, you know, cultural, any other aspect of our lives together. So, it's kind of like people ask, you know, when I was in the Blasters, like, you know, was it a hard decision to leave the Blasters? Like, no, it was really not. I mean, on their best day, the Blasters never got along as well as the Lobos do when they're fighting each other. So it's, you know, it wasn't really a hard choice.
I would assume that aside from taste in music, which I think you have a very eclectic taste in music and have worked with a very eclectic bunch of artists, probably the one piece of, or one group of material that has sort of, you've had to learn more about is probably Mexican and Chicano music, right? I mean, that's the one hole that you probably had when you joined the band that you didn't know much about, right?
Yeah, clearly. I knew, when I first joined the band, I knew literally zero. I mean, I had no, this would be, you know, early 80s, you know, I was, you know, I came to Los Angeles more or less as kind of a jazz snob, and then I was playing with kind of a white R&B band, and then the 2 or 3 years when I was living in L.A., I got sort of like deep dive into roots music, you know, what is now called Americana, I guess, but blues, rockabilly, country, you know, like all that stuff. I filled in a lot of holes in my musical knowledge. Excuse me, in the first, 4 or 5 years before I joined the Blasters, after I got to L.A., I was running with a crew that's all they thought about, that's all they played. So I kind of got educated quickly. But to be perfectly honest, when I met the guys in Los Lobos and they asked me if I wanted to learn some of their songs, I knew literally nothing about that kind of music. I had no idea. I'd never heard Norteño music. I wasn't any kind of salsa fan, so my exposure to anything of Latin culture was minimal, to say the least. But you know, I sort of an inquisitive mind, so I went on a deep dive on that stuff, and can't say I feel like I'm an expert on any level, but I'm certainly more informed than I was when I started.
Fair enough. Native Sons is a collection of covers by bands that of original songs by bands that matter to Los Lobos, and particularly bands that are from the L.A. area. Before we dive into,
well, effectively, I mean the story. I mean, basically, I can give you the backstory if you want.
Sure.
So, we after 2015, that was our last record for our former label. So for the ensuing 4 years or so, we had no label, and, you know, frankly, we really weren't looking for a label. We don't, you know, it wasn't like a big deal. You know, we just like the subject would come up, and, you know, we just didn't really care, to be perfectly honest about it. You know, we were touring with or without one, and, you know, our lives were working, you know, we were making money and touring. So we got an offer from New West in late 2019. And, it was, you know, it kind of, you know, it worked. It was a modern record deal, which is to say that it's like a 50-50 split after expenses, which is one of the things that kept us from signing other record deals, is that, you know, like, we started, you know, our first record deal was in 1982. And old-style record deals were very onerous on the artist. They were, you know, basically the entire deck was stacked for the label. You could almost, it was almost impossible to make money even with a hit record. But modern deals with modern labels, are more partnerships because the relationships have changed. So this was a, you know, a reasonable record deal with people that we knew that we liked. So we signed it, and we thought about what we were going to do. And there was, this would be what, October 2019, we were looking at our schedule thinking, well, okay, well, when could we make a record? And the answer was no time soon. We had a really extensive, you know, 2020 was going to be a busy year on paper. So we thought, well, didn't really have, you know, because generally it takes us 2 months to make a record, you know, historically speaking. So we didn't have 2 months to do that in the schedule. So we thought, well, we can do a covers record. We could do something where we can just sort of hit and go and, you know, like do it in pieces and that'll work. So it started there. And then, you know, thinking about it further, we had just finished and actually we did a Christmas record in the interim. And one of the things that we learned in the Christmas record was that when there's a focus, it makes everything easier. It makes it easier to think about, it makes it easier to talk about, it makes it easier to function if there's some guidelines around the idea. So it was my idea actually to do, make it about Los Angeles, because, you know, that's a, you know, we, the city that birthed us, even though I wasn't born there, but it birthed the band. And it was, you know, highly identified with our identity as a band. I mean, we are an LA band. So on paper, the idea made a lot of sense. But it wasn't like 100%, like not everybody on the band was fully invested in the concept. So we just thought we'd start and see where it took us. And if it didn't work, you know, I mean, we didn't announce it as an LA record, you know, LA, you know, the concept was not announced to anybody but ourselves. So we just thought if it didn't work, we could always go somewhere else. But we started and it was, you know, it was relatively, it wasn't hard. I mean, we got four songs done like in February 2020, and then the world changed. And so we stopped, obviously, and waited and wondered what, if anything, was going to happen next. And then as the travel restrictions lessened and, you know, we could sort of move around again, we went back in and just sort of finished the record in like bits and pieces, like we do like 3 or 4 days and then, you know, take 3 weeks off. I don't live in LA, so I would commute from Southern Washington where I live. Kind of pain in the ass, had to quarantine every time I come home. That sucked. But, you know, in a weird way, doing a covers record kind of aligned with our ability to function under the COVID restrictions. So it actually, in a weird way, it kind of worked out. And I think now that we're hopefully on the other end of this, or at least, you know, everybody hopes so, I mean, sort of a relatively celebratory record seems like the exactly what everybody needs right now. So I think in a weird way, it all kind of worked out a little bit, at least.
I guess after 17 records or 16 records, it's also hard to decide what there is to do next, right? I mean, there's such there's a substantive body of work at this point that it, like, where do we go from here, right?
That is also very, very true. There is a bit of, like, now what? And there's also a bit of, you know, I mean, to a certain extent, you know, again, one of the things we learned making the Christmas record is that if there isn't a, in some respect, you know, like an organizing theory of why you're doing a record, it's, you know, I mean, the world is basically, you know, tends to ignore people like bands like us. You know, our fans are there, but, and I think to a certain extent, you know, people need a reason to pay attention, you know, so it all kind of made sense on some level that it would be, you know, a record with a subject.
Before we dive into the songs on this record, I think cover songs have long been part of this band's ethos and part of how this band is recognized. You know, it's maybe a bit unfair to say that La Bamba was this band's first really big hit, and that's a cover song.
No, it's absolutely true. No, it, trust me, there's nothing else in the catalog that remotely approaches the success of La Bamba. So no, that is exactly 100% true.
But even since La Bamba, there's been other songs. You know, I think your cover, the band's cover of Bertha is very strong. I think the band's cover of West LA Fadeaway is very strong. I think there are lots of covers for this band, but they're covers that really are true to the Los Lobos sound. I mean, La Bamba, obviously, but even Bertha, to a degree, is very true to the Los Lobos sound. And I'm sure that's where you put your mark on making cover songs.
Well, yeah. I mean, we kind of feel like if we're going to do it, we need to, you know, make it ours in some respect. I mean, I think that's the job. I mean, if people wanted to hear the original, they'd go hear the original, you know? So, we try to put our spin on it, if you will, on some level. And, the main requirement for us, at least, is that the songs be fun to play. And certainly everything you mentioned, they're fun songs to play. You know, Dead songs are always a blast to play. So, it's not a lot of stringent requirements to get considered as far as we're concerned. But, I think our fans over the years have shown that they really enjoy it. You know, more often than not, it's the covers that get requested probably more than anything else. So, you know, we're well aware of how it works in our ecosphere. But at the same time, when we were thinking about doing this record, you know, we kind of steered away from the stuff we already done. I mean, not a lot, with the exception of Farmer John, was ever in our set list. To say, I don't think any of the songs were, you know, we hadn't previously done any of them at all. So that was kind of the deal. Like, we just wanted to kind of steer it elsewhere.
Well, you certainly tackled, you mentioned Farmer John, which is a song that has been in the set before and has been a band, but I think you even worked it up. It's even worked up a little bit differently. I think the pace to it on this record is different from the original recording of when you first covered it and put it down, right?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, it's funny. It's a song that's been covered a lot. One of the things that we really wanted to do was a Don and Dewey song. I don't know if you're familiar with.
Yep.
So Don and Dewey was a duo that was, I guess, discovered by Johnny Otis in the 50s. Don is Don Sugarcane Harris, who went on to play with Jefferson Starship, among others. Big influence on Dave Hidalgo. And they made amazing records. So we really, you know, we were looking high and low for a Don and Dewey song to do. And Farmer John sort of, it hit two targets, because it was also done by the Midnighters, who were a really big influence. You know, with the first song on the record is a Midnighters song. So that our arrangement is kind of the Don and Dewey arrangement and the Midnighters arrangement. Oh, there's a little bit of both of them in there. But that's kind of where that one came from. But the first time I met the band when they opened for the Blasters, they gave me a single, and Farmer John was on the B side of the single. So, yeah, it's been in the repertoire for a long time.
It's interesting that you mention that, because I know other bands have covered it, but the Neil Young cover just kind of plods along, and thank God there's a different version of it out there that's more true to the original.
Yeah, there's a couple. There's some sludgy versions. The song evidently has leeway.
Love Special Delivery is the other song by the Midnighters that you mentioned, and it opens the record. And this is a band that was so important, obviously, to Los Lobos, because they're an East LA garage band and one of the first Chicano rock groups to score a U.S. hit. How much did you know about the Midnighters before you joined the band, and did they let you in on how important that band was to the Lobos?
First question first, zero. I had never, you know, again, like in my exposure to certainly, and you know, like Latin music in general, almost nothing, and specifically the East LA sound, really zero. So it was part of my learning experience, you know, after, you know, this wasn't like the first week of me in the band. I mean, like, this is over many years. I kind of became aware of this whole East LA sound, and then I kind of figured out the cosmology of you know, all these bands, and certainly the Midnighters were the Beatles of East LA. Not, you know, they were the biggest band. They were the ones that had the most success. They were on TV a lot when the guys were growing up, and to them it seemed like, you know, they turned on the TV and they were the Beatles and there was the Midnighters, that they assumed that both bands were, you know, sort of in the same, hanging out at the same, you know, place. So it was pretty, they were huge as, you know, when the guys were very young. And then, you know, Willie, they became good friends, like Willie G, who is still, you know, very much in our world. And he sang a couple of our records now. He was on our 30th anniversary record. Dave and him have done a bunch of projects together. You know, so he's sort of in the family, more or less. You know, I just sort of, you know, among the things that I learned being in the band was all this incredible. I mean, there's some really amazing bands that came out of that scene, many of which went nowhere. But if your fans are fans of the band Chicano Batman at all, like, that's kind of the DNA of their sound. I mean, it's sort of like this strangely psychedelic take on soul music mixed with Latin music. So, yeah, it's a big part of who we are, and, you know, certainly a big part of our musical DNA.
What's interesting about this record is you go from East LA to Laurel Canyon within just a few tracks, which are...
Well, welcome to our world.
Well, yes, I understand, musically, but spiritually they are worlds apart. So I'm curious about, you know, obviously you can't talk about LA music and without discussing Laurel Canyon and Buffalo Springfield. But it just seems like worlds apart. We're obviously, now the guys are aware of Buffalo Springfield, but were bands like that part of Los Lobos's DNA early on? Were these the types of records that the guys were listening to in high school?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, that was, you know, we're all of us, even, you know, me growing up in Philadelphia, we were all children of FM radio, you know, of the 60s. So it wasn't really that unusual back then to hear, say, Cream followed by Jackson Brown, followed by the Grateful Dead. I mean, you wouldn't have heard the Midnighters, certainly, but that's kind of that was the noise in the background. So as the guys were sort of coming of age and in both our actual adolescence and our musical adolescence, those are the things that were kind of coming through the transom. So yeah, they're the, you know, I think, as Louie and Dave were sort of thinking about becoming musicians and songwriters, Buffalo Springfield was huge. And I remember that first Jackson Brown record was like, you know, where the hell did this guy come from?
Mm-hmm.
To me, like, even back then, you know, it was just like, the songs and the whole, everything just sounded so fully formed in a really interesting way. So yeah, it was we didn't do the record chronologically, but, you know, all of the people that covered were definitely part of the musical identity that we formed, you know, really that got formed before the band started even.
For What It's Worth is probably one of the most timely songs that could be sung right now. Was it purposeful to choose that song, or was it more a question of let's choose a Buffalo Springfield song and how can we not play For What It's Worth?
Well, we had been, you know, we were making this in addition to doing it under COVID. We're also making it during the run up to the election in the States, which was mildly harrowing. Put it very mildly. You know, everybody was terrified that this motherfucker could get another term. So, yeah, I mean, it's a song we had done a couple times live, not a lot, but it was certainly, you know, we weren't going to do a quote unquote protest song, and, you know, we didn't want to date stamp the record, and we never have wanted to date stamp our records, but, you know, it wasn't a long conversation when the idea of doing that song came up, like, yeah, let's do it. Absolutely. It's time. So And then the idea, I think it was Dave's idea to put it together with Bluebird, just sort of to highlight again how powerful the whole Buffalo Springfield, and you know, a lot of it is Neil. I mean, Neil was hugely influential to us in every respect to this day. I mean, he's still an enormous presence in our world, and you know, we're lucky enough to know him and gotten to play with him. But you know, that, I mean, he was, I mean, I think as songwriters, you know, Neil Jackson would probably be like top two for Louis at least.
Well, let's talk about Jamaica Say You Will, which is the Jackson Browne cover. Now, this, it's a little bit different than the original, I think. The original has real piano, and I think this cover has Fender Rhodes or electric piano at least, and it moves a little bit faster than the original. Not to say that the original isn't incredible, but I really, really like your cover of Jamaica Say You Will. It, again, is that, you know, we need to make this tune our own, and so that's why a different sort of varnish or paint was put onto this tune?
Yes, definitely. I mean, we knew we were, you know, we knew it was going to be an ambitious attempt, put it that way. You know, it's, the song is, you know, like a little bit out of our normal wheelhouse. And it took a minute to figure out, like all these songs to a certain extent had a magic key that would unlock them, at least to us, you know, like try to figure out like what really made them tick. And so we weren't as concerned about like the, you know, like the things that mattered to us in the capturing of the song was more just the vibe of it, you know, just sort of like that, you know, mid late 60s vibe. You know, vibe is a hard thing to capture. Trust me, I know. So it was sort of, you know, it took a minute to kind of get it to feel right. And it really wasn't until the background vocals went on that it felt like we had gotten it. Like I, you know, there was a couple moments where I personally wasn't sure if it was going to stick on the record just because it didn't have that vibe. And it just sort of sounded like we hadn't gotten there. But once the backgrounds got on, then it all kind of like made sense. And then I think the keyboards went on after everything else went on just to really put the bow around it. But, you know, it's a challenging song. It's got unique parts. And initially we wanted Louis to sing the whole thing and he was like, no, no way. So, you know, he ended up with one verse. You know, these are the things that went into the making of the record, but I'm really proud of it. You know, I'm really proud of the guys for sticking with it. You know, it was, you know, they could have just said, you know, screw it, let's do something easier, but they didn't. You know, everybody kind of stayed with it, and I think we got something good.
I agree. I think it's one of the best songs on the record. Talk about complicated songs. Well, let's tackle the Beach Boys. I mean, if we've managed to tackle
yeah, <right.
laughs> if we've managed to tackle Jackson Browne, let's tackle Sail on Sailor. I mean, how hard was that?
Very, extremely. So that one was our bass player Conrad is a huge Beach Boys fan. More so than I think, to be honest. Than I mean, we're all Beach Boys fans to a degree, but he's like a major Beach Boys fan. So the whole, as the record was coming together, he was adamant that we do a Beach Boys song. He was adamant that we do a Beach Boys song, and he really wanted us to do a Love, you know, the Bad Love song. And so we kind of went through the whole Love catalog first, and it was really, I mean, you really talk about complex, you know, hard to cover songs. Go listen to the catalog of Love. They're just really, really unusual conception, execution. So we thought about Seven and Seven Is, but I mean, that song is fucking crazy. So we kind of, we had to like talk him down from doing like to the last day. He was like, come on, let's do a Love song. Like, you know, he was really adamant. So more or less to keep him happy, we said, all right, let's do a Beach Boys song. So that's where, that, you know, Sail On came from initially. And that, you know, we have become very close friends with Blondie. You know, he's a guy that he's played with us and hung out with us, and so we knew him well. So that was kind of the, hey, that'd be fun, you know, do a Blondie song. But that one too, you know, it took a while to find the magic key. I mean, it was really challenging. When we first cut it, that, like those two, actually the two that you mentioned, Jamaica and that one, sat the longest in the unfinished pile just because we couldn't figure out why it wasn't working. And that one, we actually, the guy that played keyboards on both is a guy named Phil Parlapiano, who is a extraordinary player himself. I mean, he's played on a zillion records. And he sort of figured out what we were missing was actually the way that the chords were inverted, like very typical Brian Wilson fashion. Like none of the chords were straight up. They were all sort of like had a twist to them. And he sort of showed us what we were doing wrong and how to play them more or less. And then it all made sense. Then it was like, oh yeah, that's how you get that sound. So, and then once again, the background vocals were key to making it kind of feel like a Beach Boys song. And once we had that all, you know, really once Phil got done with his parts, then it really sounded like what we had hoped it would sound like.
I would imagine that a song like The World is a Ghetto is very straightforward and straight ahead, versus Jamaica, Say You Will, or Sail on Sailor, and are more akin to the roots of the band. What's cool, though, is that Little Willie G and his son are on the record.
Yeah.
How did that all come about?
Well, you know, there were a couple of stuff we knew we were going to do with or without the idea of doing an LA record. We really wanted to do, we'd never done a war song before. They were hugely influential. You know, and in addition to a Blaster song, Midnighter song, and Lalo Guerrero, those are like the absolutes. So, you know, kind of going through the war catalog, trying to come up with something we thought would fit. And, you know, a lot of these were functionally experiments, like going in, like we just sort of, like when we cut that one, it was like, well, let's just see what happens. Let's see if we could pull it off. And, it was less of a magic key with that one than, again, like just trying to capture the vibe of it, trying to get something that sort of sound, because the war records really have a unique vibe. I mean, they all sound like they were recorded at a party.
Yeah.
In some respect, you know, they all have this incredibly loose thing going on, but at the same time, there's, you know, great musicianship, and the, you know, the grooves are always like super, super solid. And, you know, like I said, we took a shot at it, and it sort of had this nice, I mean, it was initially like probably 4 or 5 minutes longer. There was a lot more jamming on it, and things just sort of stretched out, but we kind of cut it down to a more manageable length. And then we thought about, like, you know, having the vocals trade, you know, like Caesar sings a verse, Dave sings a verse, and then, well, there's three verses, now what? And then I think it was Dave's idea to get Willie involved because, like I said, he's been in our musical family for quite some time. So, yeah, it was sort of like put a little, again, a bow around the whole thing to have him, basically a Midnighter song to start the record, and functionally speaking, having Willie sing on the last song of the record seemed to make sense for, you know, the kind of influence that he and his band have been to us. And then just being able to finally get a war song and do it right was kind of huge, because we're good friends. You know, the war family now is split in two. There's the Lonnie side and everybody else. So, and we're actually close to both. So it was kind of cool to be able to do one and hopefully make the warring factions happy.
And the final song that I wanted to ask you about is a song that you've obviously know really well. It's Flat Top Joint. And obviously there had to be a Blaster song on this record.
Yep.
And that one just, I mean, it's a fiery cover of the original. It just makes sense that that's the track on this record from the Blasters, right?
Yeah. That, you know, another absolute, you know, we couldn't do this record without doing a Blaster song. And that was one of the first ones we cut, I think. I think that was the first one we cut once we came back to the studio after the lockdown. So I think I just remember that, like, the first day of, like, you know, traveling, everything about travel being super weird, and just going through, you know, mostly empty streets in Los Angeles, which was super weird, and like getting to the studio and everybody's masked up, which was super weird. And, you know, that whole first thing, that first moment of being back around humans after, you know, a couple of months was, again, all of this was super weird, but there we were in the studio. They're kind of like, okay, well, now what? Mm-hmm. we're all here, you know, what are we going to do? And I think, you know, it was like, all right, well, let's try a Blaster song. So it was, I think it was a first take, not first take, probably second take, you know, just sort of like it played itself more or less. It was, we didn't really, you know, a lot of these, we sort of had to study it before we recorded it.
Right.
And that one, we just knew from, you know, genetic memory or something. I don't know. Another, we just played it and that's what happened. So, yeah, it was sort of like, it kind of broke the ice after, you know, a really weird time. And it was like, okay, you know, this is what we're here for. This is what we do. It's not going to be that hard. Let's just do it.
Do you think that this band was aware of just how eclectic their sound was? You know, way ahead of their time in terms of how eclectic the influences were and how they made music that didn't necessarily fit in sort of any of the preconceived genre bins that a record store has. Probably wasn't purposeful. They just had a lot of influences, but were they aware that they kind of didn't fit, or were record labels quick to tell them that they didn't fit anywhere? Like, you take on this persona of a band that's all over the place, right?
Well, you know, if you think about it, like back to the first EP, even that was kind of the given, you know, like there was a Latin side and a, you know, rock side, and this, you know, sort of weird, at that time, at least, there was a weird juxtaposition between the various genres. And then, you know, like Caesar wrote in the more or less a blues idiom, and David Lewis sort of had a slightly more songwritery thing. So there's always been a lot of colors in the palette. And to be perfectly honest, like, we never really thought about it, like, you know, like what it was that we were doing. Like, we just did the stuff that made us happy, you know, like we just played, you know, did it till the song sounded good to us. I never really thought about what barrel it was supposed to fit in. To this day, I mean, we still don't really think about it, you know, in any realistic sense, like where this, you know, like we just do it and, you know, kind of let the world figure it out. But, you know, I mean, are we aware of our eclecticism? I mean, you know, we're certainly aware of our influences, but,
right,
you know, I think even from the first days, like the idea was to sort of mix and match this stuff and try and figure out our own vocabulary and, you know, pay homage to our influences, but by no means are we there to, you know, just spit them out. Like, you know, even like the earliest stuff, like our take on the Norteña stuff, like that's kind of like that first stuff that I learned when I joined the band, like, you know, our, you know, it's, what we do to those songs is much closer to punk rock than,
right,
the historical,
yes,
the proper method of playing them. I remember a funny story. The early days, you know, Chris Strachwitz, or Hoogly Records, you know, he's sort of like the, you know, he's still with us, thankfully, but, you know, they're like they captured all of these, a lot of music that influenced Los Lobos was captured by Chris and our Hoogly Records and Ry Cooter. I mean, you know, you name it, they're, you know, our Hoogly was there capturing these original sounds. So he, some reason, you know, he's based in Berkeley, and he would always come see us play. Well, you know, we used to play the Bay Area quite a bit, and he would come, and every show he'd come and go, he has a thick German accent. He goes, you play it too goddamn loud and too goddamn fast all the time, too goddamn loud, too goddamn fast. He was so upset, but he would always come back to every show just because we were at least doing it. I mean, there wasn't anybody else really playing this kind of music but us. So, you know, we always sort of had our own version of how this stuff's supposed to sound. So like I said, it's built in.
What's next? That's a huge, broad, sweeping question, but is the plan is obviously now that the world is opening up a bit to tour a little bit more, and then is there an opportunity to go back in the studio and make another original record for number 18? Is that eventually the goal?
Yes, that will happen. That certainly was New West's anticipation when they signed us, that they're going to get a record of original. So yes, there will be one, but I think for now, like every other musician on the planet, we're all just trying to figure out that same question. Like what now? Like what, how safe is it even? Like what is it going to look like? So yeah, we're still right now, we're not thinking about the next one at all. We're just thinking about, effectively speaking, our touring schedule is, I won't say it's full, but it's certainly it's full till New Year's,
right,
2022. And then well into next year as well. So I would say probably 2023 would be the target for anything new. We'll see. I mean, but for now, I think we're just going to do this one and see where it goes and, just kind of have fun with the, all these songs are super fun to play and share with people and, just kind of share the joy of being back among people again. And I don't know. But yes, I think the long answer to your question, yeah, I would say I'd look at, 2023 probably for a new original record.
You mentioned the band's influences. Are you guys aware of the influences that you've had on others? I know that, Phish covers when the Circus Comes to Down. Are you aware of the influence that this band has had on a new breed of musicians who appreciate the music you've made?
I'd say yes. We certainly, we love the fact that Phish covered that song. I think their version's great. I think to a certain extent we are, but then also to a certain extent, it's like, I think, we still feel like we're sort of off doing our own thing in our own weird little cave somehow. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't, I can't say I could point to anybody or anything that's like, okay, well, these guys are going to carry the flag after we're off the stage. You know what I mean? So, yes, to a certain degree, and by all means, everybody that's covered any of our songs, I just enjoy the shit out of myself. Tom Jones, give me a break. Like, who would have thought of that?
Right.
But at the same time, I can't say, it's not like, I'm good friends with like Peter Buck and REM. It's like, there's a million bands that, there's a direct, it's part of, the blood, it's the same blood type, it's not like, you have to go through the genetic record to figure out what the connection is. And I would say, with us, I'm honored that people consider us an influence, but it's harder, I guess, for me to sit here and say, well, yeah, like, I hear us in this band or that band. I think there's a lot of bands that certainly, they've listened to us a bunch, and I hope that they learn, stuff, but it's not quite the same.
Agreed.
To me, at least.
Agreed.
I wasn't trying to say that, but I think it's more just like, I think we all think that we're just still a bunch of weirdos making strange records.
Well, we appreciate it. So thank you so much for taking the time, and thanks for this record, and thanks for sharing these songs with us again. Cheers. All the best.
My pleasure. Thank you, man. I really appreciate it.
For more on Los Lobos, including tour dates and a chance to pre-order Native Sons out July 30th on New West Records, visit loslobos.org. Before we leave you, how about we listen to another track off of Native Sons? Here is Flat Top Joint, originally by The Blasters.
Kids called the flat top joint. Flat top joint. The band starts rocking at midnight. Boy, you know you can't stand still. They got barbecue ribs.
you're gonna find one there down at the flat top joint. Flat top joint. Plays for free down at the flat.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.